and welcome to Counsel for the State. I'm Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin. Counsel for the State is a podcast produced by my office. Our goal in each episode is to share information with Idaho residents, journalists, and anyone with an interest in state government. Our aim is to increase transparency, further understanding of the office's role in government, and discuss timely legal topics. I hope you enjoy this installment and consider exploring past episodes as well. With that, here is the Office of the Attorney General, Public Information Officer, and Counsel for the State host, Scott Graff.
Hello and welcome to Episode 7 of Counsel for the State. Today we discuss the Idaho Internet Crimes Against Children Unit. First, a reminder that the podcast is available online at the AG's website, that is ag.idaho.gov. Anyone can listen there for free. Just look for the big blue button that says podcast under the picture of the Attorney General. Counsel for the State also, by the way, available through your usual podcast outlets like Google Play Music, iTunes, and Spotify. In today's episode, we discuss the work of a unit that is housed in the Attorney General's Criminal Law Division. The Internet Crimes Against Children Unit, often referred simply to as ICAC, investigates and arrests individuals who use the Internet to prey on young people. The Attorney General has referred to the work done by ICAC staff as important as any that's done in the entire office. To discuss the unit and some ways parents can keep their children safe online as everyone heads back to school for another academic year, we welcome two members of the unit. Chris McCormick is the ICAC commander. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us, Scott.
And alongside is Mark Dalton. Mark is an investigator in the ICAC unit. Mark, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Scott.
We're also joined by Brian Kane, Office of the Attorney General's Assistant Chief Deputy. Brian, welcome.
Thanks, Scott.
Chris, we will start with you. When you meet folks, let's say, the conversation with a stranger turns towards what you do, what do you say about ICAC? Can you kind of briefly summarize what it is that you and your unit do?
Absolutely. ICAC is a national network of 61 task forces across the country. It represents over 4,500 federal, state, local, and tribal agencies, all coming together for the common purpose of, you know, detecting, deterring, and prosecuting those that prey on our children.
Talk about some of your numbers, your staff size, your budget size, et cetera.
Absolutely. You know, Idaho ICAC's somewhat unique, whereas we're both state and federally funded. We've got a state budget of approximately $2.2 million that's supplemented by an additional $200,000 a year through a federal state grant. With that, you know, we're able to employ 19 full-time staff. This includes 14 investigators, 4 forensic examiners, and 1 administrative assistant. The bulk or the lion's share of these employees are housed here out of the Boise office. However, we've got 4 affiliates throughout the state, and they work out of the respective agencies.
And you also just got a new affiliate, right?
We did, and that would be the Idaho Falls. We had one in Bonneville County, which was located in Idaho Falls. We've not got one from Idaho Falls Police Department as well, Brian.
Yeah, the legislature just added that this past session for folks that aren't aware. Now, when you said that there's 61 different?
61, each
so
state has
some states have more than one?
Absolutely. You know, California, a good example. You got North, South, Central, just because of the sheer number of people there in their state.
Sure, but you're the only show in town in Idaho.
We are, but we do a darn good job with what we've got. So
for the two of you, Chris, you've become the ICAC commander within the last year here. Talk about some of your work prior to that.
Absolutely. I've been in law enforcement approximately 23 years. You know, the bulk of that was a supervisor in investigations. So investigations are relatively similar. However, this one's, you know, got a little bit of a twist, whereas, you know, it's certainly good to put away bad guys for anything from burglaries to shootings to whatever, but it's hard to, there's really nothing that comes close to protecting our state's children. That's huge.
And I see on Mark's chest, around his neck, he is wearing his badge. And Chris, I think you wear yours on your belt. But my point being that everyone in ICAC, pretty much everyone, post-certified law enforcement officers in
Absolutely.
The state of Idaho.
Not only are they post-certified, but we try to recruit the best of the best. We've got some of the best investigators today working for us. And we don't bring somebody that just recently become law enforcement. These are tenured, very good investigators with very good bios.
Mark, this is very, very different work, even in the realm of law enforcement. What is it about this type of work that has appealed to you to have you doing it for how many years now?
I've been in law enforcement for almost 18 years now, and started out coming up through the ranks from detention all the way up to investigations. And the difference that I've noticed through being with ICAC is that we actually do save people. We've executed search warrants where we've actually been able to protect and prevent these things from happening to children. And two occasions that I know of since being here for the last 3 years. But usually in law enforcement, it's usually a reactive issue, and you're not really out there to you don't really get a chance to save somebody. And this is the one opportunity that we actually do get to have that.
So this is a really good example of kind of the capabilities of proactive law enforcement, you know, through this unit. I know you talked briefly about budget numbers, but it sounds like if you've got that kind of proactive ability, that really justifies whatever the budget is.
Absolutely.
You can't put any cost on a children's safety. Like Mark was saying, it's completely different to actually work a case, do all the backstory, all the background, and then come in contact with that same kid that you've spent 2-3 months trying to build a case on. It's a good feeling. It's an absolutely incredible feeling.
And the support, one thing that we should mention is from the legislature has been very strong for the ICAC unit. When the Attorney General spoke in January or February during the most recent legislative session, there was actually not an ask in the budget for another ICAC position. But Chris, I'll let you take it from there. Explain what happened and how the legislature once again showed its support.
Yeah, you know, we were fortunate enough to have somebody on the legislature that identified the fact that we could certainly need more help on the western side of the state. Because of that, they were willing to fund us another position in Idaho Falls. Just to put some perspective on this, a lot of our, probably the majority of the tips that our agency runs with is fielded to us from National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Right now in the queue, we're sitting at about 710 cases. We talked before, we have 19 investigators, 710 active cases. So it doesn't matter how hard we try, and I guarantee you we give 110% here, there's always going to be more cases than investigators. So the fact that the legislature identified that without us even asking was just speaks volumes for the type of work that we do.
That 700 cases, is that number fairly static? Like you've been with the office a few years. Is there always kind of that outstanding caseload? Or
we've hovered high sixes, low sevens throughout probably the last couple, 3 years I've been with the agency. It's not uncommon. You know, those go from anything from, you know, in-progress offenses to people exchanging photos they shouldn't have, you know, to a lot there in between. So, yes, I guess to answer your question, 700 is a pretty accurate figure for what we're sitting on pretty regularly.
Mark, can you take a moment and sort of run us through what a typical case looks like that ICAC works? Chris just mentioned the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. A lot of tips come in through the NCMEC organization. But once that tip comes in the door, explain how ICAC goes to work.
Well, once we get the tip, it'll be reviewed by our supervisors, and then they will dole it out based on who is available for caseload and everything. And we will take the information enclosed in the cyber tip and start to extract data that we can use to identify a suspect. From there, we'll issue subpoenas on internet service providers or cell phone companies or anything to get further information that will lead us further down the line for investigations. And once we can locate and identify a suspect, that's when we'll start to go out and do eyeball surveillance on them, get a pattern. We'll start looking at getting search warrants, either state or federally, based upon, you know, the content of the cyber tip. And then we will plan an operation, and they're generally going to be joint operations where we're going to have multiple jurisdictions. And then we will go execute that warrant, knock on the door, and interview the suspect. And a lot of the times, vast majority of them will either tell us to, give us all the information and we'll be able to make an arrest right then based on what we find on their computers. Or they'll tell us that, no, I'm going to lawyer up, and then we just compile the case, write everything up, issue it to the prosecuting attorney, and then they will file for warrants.
And that is sort of, Chris, where the ICAC unit steps away. That case, it goes to it's an arrest, and then the prosecution is not handled by the ICAC unit, correct?
Correct. You know, where we're a little bit unique as well is we work hand-in-hand with our prosecutors from the get-go on these. They're helping us or assisting us getting search warrants with subpoenas and everything on the front end. So by the time that we, you know, get to the point of filing charges, they're well-versed on what we've got going. They're making suggestions along the way. We're making suggestions, and this cooperative agreement leads to, it's been very successful in our prosecutions.
We're about to shift gears and talk about tips for parents, but before we move on to that part of our conversation, talking about sort of the collaborative teamwork that ICAC has going with other outside agencies. There was a pretty big development earlier this year in regards to the deputization of 7 or 8 of the ICAC investigators obtaining sort of some federal credentials. Chris, will you take a moment and explain what happened and the significance of that development?
Absolutely. Idaho ICAC has been working with our federal partners since its inception. You know, oftentimes it's better practice to prosecute these federally. However, it's been cumbersome in the past, whereas we would have to go through their attorneys to get an audience in front of a judge to get a lot of the search warrants that we need. What this has done is it has streamlined this process. It's enabled our investigators to act as the affiants in this. It streamlined the process, made it a little bit quicker. It's also seems that the U.S. Attorney's Office is a little bit more inclined to take a lot of our cases. So this partnership has just got strengthened from what it was before.
It's easier to, because of this cross-deputization now, to take a case that may or may not result in federal charges and go ahead and actually prosecute in the federal system. Why is that a good thing for some cases and not necessarily for others?
You know, each has its own pros and cons, state and federal. You know, federal has provisions that the state don't have and vice versa. And what we're doing is we're looking for, I guess, the most benefit out of the prosecution. Sometimes that's going to be state, oftentimes it's going to be federal, but the relationships we have on both sides gives us the opportunity to decide which direction we want to go in this.
And a lot of these cases cross state lines.
Oh, absolutely.
Once you cross state lines, that immediately invokes that layer of federal jurisdiction if it's necessary.
Correct.
And I think, you know, as we go through this kind of more mobile age, we can't forget, you know, that the ease with which these transmissions and these conversations and everything that's taking place online goes across state lines and kind of bounces around quite a bit.
Good example being an operation, I believe, in March of 2018. And that was a many, many jurisdictional operation that took place in Boise. And there were suspects that ended up coming, I believe, from Oregon. And I think those subjects who were arrested were charged federally, perhaps in part because of the multiple states involved. One of the things besides, you know, the obvious component of law enforcement that ICAC does is outreach to try and head these problems off at the pass, to educate parents, educate educators, and also educate children so they are using the internet more wisely and thus protecting themselves online. And you are one of the faces of that outreach effort. Explain, I think this could be an entire probably series of podcasts, you know, how to keep kids safe online. But when you go out to the schools and other, you know, outreach events that you do, what is some of your main messaging to the parents, to the educators, and to the kids about just how in the world a kid can stay safe online in 2019?
Well, a lot of it is for parents to understand that, you know, they will always be behind the curve of their children. Their children intrinsically know how to work these devices. It's amazing. I will ask students all the time, you know, are you better at devices than your parents? Every hand goes up. Now, the problem with that is that parents will not think anything about it because they think it's just a phone. Well, out of the top 20 uses for a cellular device now, using it as a phone call is 10 out of 20.
Wow.
They'll use it for 10 other things before they'll use it for a phone call.
Wow.
And
it's funny that you mentioned that because we actually had a little bit of a family kerfuffle because I had asked my son to check in, you know, after an hour. He was out in the neighborhood, and I just wanted to know where he was and that everything was okay. And so he texted instead of called, which was fine with me, but he had the same arrangement with his grandmother, and he texted her and got in trouble for sending a text instead of a phone call. And so, you know, there are folks out there that still use them as phones.
Yep, absolutely. And the further back in the generations you go, the right. more it's right. going to be.
The higher the ranking of the phone use.
Yeah. Yep, yeah, absolutely.
So in those positions between 1 and 9, there's some nefarious things that can be happening to kids.
Absolutely.
What are the sort of things that parents have to be on the lookout for these days?
Most of the things that they have to look out for is that they've got to educate themselves on what is out there. Kids will always find the newest, latest, greatest, and they will constantly share it. If it's not on their phone, they'll borrow a friend's phone. So just taking a device away isn't going to solve a problem. Now, a lot of the things that parents need to educate themselves on are a lot of these applications that are out there, a lot of the websites that are in use, that kids seemingly think are very innocent, but there are literally hundreds of sites that, you know, were designed and built with the best of intentions, but will always mutate into something else just based on the way people use them.
How about an example instead of curiosity?
Like Instagram. Instagram was just a sharing site, you know, quick chats, you know. And unfortunately, through its massive amount of use, it's got over a billion users now. And that has now become the number one site for cyberbullying. So Instagram has finally grasped the concept and are starting to implement AI and other programs that will try and filter out a lot of the bullying issues and stuff. They're actually taking some proactive steps in that regard.
And I think that circles back to your earlier point nicely, that, you know, the youth are kind of ahead of the curve of a lot of the rest of us. Because I know that there are probably a lot of parents out there that feel like they're pretty savvy, you know, because they're active on Facebook or Pinterest or Twitter. Mm-hmm. Yet the reality is that their kids aren't active in those spaces at all. And a number, I mean, if you look at the current teen demographic, they're not opening Facebook accounts or Twitter accounts, but they are absolutely opening Instagram accounts. And that's, I mean, if you're a parent, the workhorse of teen communication right now is Instagram.
Instagram and Snapchat. Absolutely.
The best way to clean it up actually is for all of us as parents to get on there, and then we'll push the kids off to some other site.
That's what we did on Facebook.
Make it way less cool.
Only old right. people now use Facebook.
Nothing ruins a good site like the parents showing up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just to interject real quick, you bring up a valid point. General rule of thumb, if you are not familiar with an application, there is absolutely no reason I can think of that your child should have that application. You know, if you're going to allow them to have Instagram, you're going to allow them to have whatever the case may be, please get this a month or two ahead of time. Familiarize yourself with the ins, the outs, and everything you need to know before your child is allowed to use that application.
What about your kids' privacy? Would you recommend that parents know their accounts and passwords and whatnot?
Absolutely. There is no privacy. It's not their phone. You're giving them the phone. You're giving them the access. You're paying for everything. It's not theirs.
Sure.
So there is no privacy.
Sure.
Nor should there be.
What about other steps? Like, say, for example, as a parent, you were to say, hey, you know what? We're not going to have devices in rooms, right? They're only going to be in common areas and that. I mean, are there steps that...
There are a lot of things that you can do. You can turn off your Wi-Fi between given hours, and that way they are limited to just the basic features of the phone. But the most dangerous thing is a lot of times kids will, not only will it affect, be a danger to them, but also be a health issue for them as well, having that device in their rooms. They will want to stay on and play because it's that FOMO. That's what they call it. It's fear of missing out. They always have to be on. They have to know what everybody's doing at all hours, and that will cost them sleep.
Thus, all the articles I'm starting to see on social media detox.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, the health benefits of just getting off of the...
Not just for kids.
No.
Right, yeah, and I think that there's...
It's the dopamine rush that they get from it. I mean, that's no different than alcohol or cocaine or any other illicit drug. It creates the same pleasure-seeking chemical release that you get in your brain as you do when you're online. And all of these applications and sites are designed to keep you on and keep you hooked.
Right. If I post a picture and I get a like, that's a dopamine rush, right? Because
yeah.
I'm popular and that makes me feel good, which does two things, right? It makes me want to stay on the site, but it also makes me want to put a new post on there.
You have to stay current.
And yeah, which then could create one-upmanship within teen ranks, right? Oh, you showed a picture of you jumping your bike over the creek. Well, I'm going to jump my bike over a flaming barrel in the creek.
Yeah. And just for posting sake, they get credit because they will run streaks. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge social status among the youth nowadays. I had one gentleman who had to sign over his account to us on a case. And 5 years of streaks, now gone.
Ooh.
And that just about devastated him.
Wow. So I'm sitting here, I'm thinking about my future as a father. And what I'm hearing is this takes an incredible amount of work on the parents' part to sort of play the role. But also this is something that parents are going through for the first time. This is not something that our parents had to deal with. And we sort of saw a playbook, 30 years ago on how they handled this situation, where this is a new frontier and parents are sort of on the cutting edge of this, if you will, as challenging as that might be. But this is not something that a parent who's doing this right and handling this right in their house, they're not just spending a little bit of time on. This is something that they have to make a dedicated effort to stay on top of. Not just learn once, but then, do maintenance and continue to learn apps.
Oh, absolutely. These apps change constantly. There are new developments every day. They will upgrade constantly, and the features will change.
And I think the other aspect of that we can't overlook is the societal pressure to participate in this space. If you think about it in terms of, just look around whatever school you're in, how many kids starting in about first grade have phones? And that number just increases as they go through the school. And there's an intense amount of pressure for you to participate in that space. And at times it can be so much pressure that it's hard to believe that we were able to grow up without even having these devices.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so I think that's an excellent point, because it's completely unrealistic to expect probably a teenager at this point in time to never have a phone. This is something, learning about a device is something that all kids are probably going to have to do at some point. Mark, Chris, I'll let either one of you.
That is their life.
Yep.
Because everywhere they go, that's where they live it now.
So is there sort of an ideal scenario? These are waters that you swim in every single day. When you go out, Mark, and you make these presentations to parents, do you say, no phones before 16, no phones before 17? Like, what is...
No, it's a personal thing, but they have to be prepared for it. Now, the biggest thing that if I could stress it on to parents is, when we were kids, it was stranger danger. They taught that and they drilled that into you, right?
Yeah.
Well, they didn't teach that for online use. And it's more important to continue that stranger danger factor in online use, because how many applications are out there that are designed to bring you strangers? Now,
and I think that's a really important point, because I think that almost all of our children still have that stranger danger instinct, right? If somebody approached them that they didn't know on the street, they would not respond, and they'd probably run to wherever they need to go and take care of themselves entirely appropriately. But that same person hides behind the veneer of the internet or a social media app, all of a sudden that doubt is gone. And that's the thing that we can't lose, is that doubt is the same doubt as the person on the street.
And that's what our predators are taking advantage of. You know, the anonymity you've got on the internet. You know, I could be a 14-year-old little boy that goes to a school down the street from you, and automatically we're best friends. We're talking about things when realistically that's not what I am. It's the same strangers out there, but they're certainly masked much better than when the four of us grew up.
Well, and I would imagine too, you know, sort of that dopamine rush that everyone on social media gets when, you know, a tweet gets a bunch of likes or retweets, et cetera, whatever that may be. Maybe it's a Facebook, you know, post that gets a lot of activity. I would imagine teenagers, if you're 14, you're probably more susceptible.
Oh, yes.
To that, and that can be used by people who have nefarious things in mind as sort of the end to start a conversation, and the child, of course, has no idea where that conversation, that other person hopes it will end up.
That's true.
I think the other part of that is to make sure that kids feel safe enough to come forward when they're put in that situation. I know that as parents, sometimes we have a tendency to think, oh, what were you doing on that site? And you immediately want to punish them. Well, if you make that reaction, you may be signaling to the kid, I need to conceal this the next time it happens. And really, the safest thing for your family is for them to know, if I bring this up, yes, I made a mistake, but it's also going to be taken care of and addressed.
Absolutely.
Kind of gives me a knot in my stomach as a parent, because it is such a new thing. Like I said, we're in uncharted territory here as parents, but you know, the societal pressures, the kid is going to end up with an iPad or a phone or whatever. But I suppose you would probably say, you know, that burying my head in the sand here is going to be the absolute worst thing I could do.
Absolute worst.
There's a lot of work to be done, and you have to be, as a parent, you have to be extremely engaged to make sure that you're doing everything you can to protect your kids.
Absolutely. And fortunately for parents such as myself, there are so many resources out there that go through the basics. You know, there's age appropriate. You know, not only is it letting us as parents know what to look for, what to expect, but it's also giving stuff that we can give our teens, our tweens, our children, resources. So when they do see something that just doesn't seem right, they know where to go or what to say. So kind of segues into our website. We'll go on to that a little bit later. But if you simply Google, you know, online protection, online safety tips, you know, you could get hundreds and hundreds, and all of them have their place. Please, as a parent, stay informed. Know what your child is doing. You know, a lot of us think that, well, it's an imposition, I don't want to be that parent. You also don't want to be that parent that has to come down to the police station because, hey, your kid is a victim of something that happened that was internet related.
And I think just to add on to that, because I think it's really, really important, the tools are out there for parents to know what their children are doing, but also to keep the conversation going, right? The device isn't a set it and forget it. You don't hand it over and then you're like, oh, I've done everything that I can. We had a conversation about safe device use. I'm out. Good luck. You know, just thinking about the iPhone, which I'll use as an example, you know, it has family sharing. And when you enter into that family sharing, you can set downtime for the phone. So, for example, you can turn it off during school hours or at night when they're supposed to be in bed. You can approve all app purchases so they can't buy an app without your approval. And, you know, one of the great things about that tool isn't necessarily your control as a parent over your child. It's the number of entry points that you have for a conversation with your children about what they're doing on their device, right? If you have to approve those apps, it's not that you want to block them from having fun on their phone. It's, what app are you putting on there? Why do you want to use this? What's it going to do? Is it something I should learn about? Which we've learned already. The answer is yes, you should. But it's those entry points, right? Making sure that kids know this is a conversation we're going to have in our house a lot.
Mark, when you have those conversations as a parent with a kid, I'm curious, how much do you say about sort of, you know, the bad things that could be happening if they are to go astray?
You have to be absolutely open and honest with your kids. And I mean, they're gonna find it. When we were kids, you know, the access to a lot of the really horrible things on the internet that are free out there 24/7, we really had to struggle to find when we were kids. It just wasn't there. But now it's everywhere. So parents really need to just be open and honest with kids. One of the amazing factors that I found when I was preparing for a lot of the programs that I've done is that of the top 10 searches in the United States, with Google.com being the number one search and the next being YouTube, out of those top 10, 3 are pornographic sites.
Is that right?
Out of the top 10 searches. So you have to prepare your kids, because if you won't teach them, somebody at school will.
Well, and I remember, gosh, this is going back to the mid-1990s when, early in high school, and the internet finally came into my high school, just how tempting it was as kids to go, I can get, access to, I was a huge Steelers fan, for instance, so I was going to the Pittsburgh newspaper websites and reading all the Steelers articles that I could. But not long after that, there's a tendency as a kid to go, oh, my goodness, what else could I be looking up? And what else is out there to be searching? And it just sort of seems instinctual as maybe a teenager that you are going to push the limits of whatever it is. And in this case, it's access to information, some of it good and some of it certainly not so good.
Absolutely.
What are some of the resources? You mentioned resources, or Chris mentioned resources. What are your favorites to point parents to as they sort of arm themselves to prepare their children for this frontier?
Well, one of the really great ones that we kind of promote is it's called FOSI. It's the Family Online Safety Institute, and it's just FOSI.org.
FOSI.
Yes, sir. And that has really great resources and educational information for parents. For kids of all ages, from children, grade schoolers, up through high schoolers, netsmarts.org, and that's netsmartz.org. That is a website that is run through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and they have all kinds of videos, training curriculum for parents, teachers, law enforcement, children, and that is a phenomenal resource.
Okay. And one of the functions you mentioned that you go out into communities across the state, you and other ICAC staff as well, talk about those programs and sort of your availability for folks who might be just learning of ICAC's involvement in that arena to maybe have you or other staff come and do presentations.
Well, that's part of our edict for being an ICAC task force, is that we have to go out and do presentations and public information to get this information out to others. So this is just as important as doing investigations. Now, we will go out anytime, anywhere in the state, and it doesn't matter if I've made presentations to as few as 6 individuals before, and those are generally unfortunate to say that those very sparsely attended presentations are generally when it's a parent's presentation.
Hmm.
Students, it's a controlled environment. They're right. forced
They've
to sit
be
through
there.
It. Exactly.
Right.
But parents...
Well, that leads to the question, do you think parents understand everything that they should be doing?
They really don't. When I talk with kids, a lot of times we'll ask them, what kind of training did your parents give you? And it's from none at all to, don't go to any bad sites. And that's basically it. So basically what parents are doing is, here's the keys to the car, don't kill yourself.
Yeah.
And that's it. Because these devices that they carry in their hands, they don't understand the magnitude of the reach that these have and the dangers that are out there. And so if they're not teaching their kids, someone else would be more than happy to.
Do you know of any schools that have incorporated training in this arena for children when it comes to curriculum, sort of like an enrichment unit or something like that?
Several schools do have IT groups that are assigned, and they do training. I've noticed it mostly not in the public forum, but in private schools.
So if I'm just listening to this podcast and having this kind of epiphany of I missed a couple conversations and I'm worried about what my kids are doing, are there any things that I should look at as far as usage of devices that should be red flags as a parent that, hey, it's time to have a conversation or we need to sit down and talk?
There are a lot of things that are going to come up, and a lot of them will be displayed in behaviors. You're going to see those quick behavioral changes. A kid will start to become more isolated. They won't be as outgoing. They're going to be a lot more secretive. If you ask for their phone, watch their reaction. Mm-hmm. If they, no, you can't have it, it's my phone, that's a huge red flag. It's so much easier to do proper training before you give them the device than to try and rectify problems that will arise after the fact.
Chris, Mark, I can't remember which one of you. I believe I've heard one of you offer up a sort of an analogy to a loaded gun, handing a child a loaded gun without any instruction.
Oh, and that's essentially what it is. These devices that we carry every day. Just 50 years ago, we sent men to the moon. Well, these devices now have more speed, more power, more processing ability than those computers. Mm-hmm. And you just now carry that in your pocket. So we have to understand the power that comes with this. And like everybody says, with great power comes great responsibility. Not only do parents that are giving up this power have to be responsible, children need to understand how responsible they're going to have to be.
On the presentation, before we put a bow on that part of our conversation, if folks want to get a hold of you or someone in ICAC to maybe schedule a presentation this fall or over the wintertime, how should they go about getting a hold of you guys?
Yeah, there's a couple ways to get a hold of ICAC. Our general number that's manned from 7 to 4 each day is 208-947-8700. We're also in the process of creating an email address, which will be information@icacidaho.org. That'll give you general information, any questions you have, reference the unit. There's also going to be a third component, which is going to be presentations@icacidaho.org, which is going to give viewers or the public the ability to converse with Mark directly to set up presentations or see what material is available.
And those email addresses are being set up as part of our new effort to overhaul a pretty outdated and lacking ICAC website and turning that into much more of a resource. So that is a process that is just getting underway, and we hope to have that live here in the next probably couple of months.
Sounds
so
accurate.
In the meantime, the best way to get a hold of the ICAC unit is going to be that phone number, 208-947-8700, but
correct.
We will be announcing the new ICAC website when it is up and running, and it will have a lot of great features for interaction between parents, educators, and others, the folks of the ICAC unit. So I think with that, we can wrap up here. Mark Dalton, before we do, any parting words to parents who are hearing this messaging for the first time?
Just be more involved in what your kids are doing. You have to be the educated one and know where your kids are going.
Okay.
And just, you have to be open and honest with them. You know, set those ground rules early and stick by them.
Chris, parting words?
Scott, to echo what Mark said, you know, the biggest takeaway here is stay informed, stay involved. If there's anything that catches your attention, please contact local law enforcement. Let us look into it for you.
That is the voice of ICAC Commander Christopher McCormick, also Mark Dalton, an investigator with the ICAC unit on the program today. Brian Kane, the Assistant Chief Deputy, a voice here on Episode 7 of the podcast as well. That will wrap up this episode of Council for the State. If you have not heard any of our other podcasts, you can check those out on the AG's website, that is ag.idaho.gov, or at places like iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play Music. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to see you again for our next episode.